Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Amanda Carpenter actually claims that she was off social media for an entire week on vacation, spending time with her family. See, I always assume that people in the media and politics who say that, hey, I have to get off Twitter to spend more time with my family are making it up. But you actually did do that, didn't you, Amanda?
I did, and it was shockingly fun. My kids now are 7 and 9. And so they are now actually really fun to hang out with. You know, before it's a lot of caretaking, making sure they get fed on time and not cranky. Uh-huh. And did you pack your stuff? But now that all the hand-holding has started to recede and they can actually, you know, go a couple hours without needing a snack and melting down, it's really fun.
No, they're actually people now. So
yes, we went to Mount Vernon for a day trip. I mean, we didn't go any crazier, just around the house, cleaned out my garage. Yay. But we hiked all around there. They did a Hamilton tour at Mount Vernon where you have a guide that takes you around and he explains all the references in Hamilton, the movie, which they're sort of familiar with. I mean, they don't really get all of it, especially the second half, which is kind of adult. But they knew enough to latch onto it. And so I highly recommend that if you have kids and you come to the Washington area. I think it's better than the Smithsonian. They have like a map where they can check off things and learn about it. It was great. We could have easily spent a couple more days there. There's so much to walk and see and just enjoy, especially on a beautiful spring day. So
you discovered that you had a life and that was interesting, which is, I mean, I'm looking forward to that at some point. it's a prospect. People are going, hey, what is that actually like? Okay, so you come back in time for all kinds of things that are happening. Many important things are happening. The massive infrastructure deal that the White House is unveiling, the debate over voting rights, Capitol cops suing Donald Trump. We have an internal memo from the House GOP basically saying we have to double down on support for Trump. But before we get it, and of course, the big debate now over vaccine passports, because we needed another cultural war. We'd exhausted all of the other cultural wars. So now it's going to become mask mandates and vaccines. But before we get into any of that, I'm sorry. You know, I'm just not scared. I know it's coming. No, I guess I'm not going to pretend that I have not opened up a big box of popcorn for this Matt Gaetz story. Okay. The Pizza Gaetz story. Big headline in the New York Times. Matt Gaetz is said to face Justice Department inquiry over sex with an underage girl. And if that wasn't juicy enough, he goes on Tucker Carlson's show last night in what even Tucker Carlson describes as one of the weirdest interviews he ever had. So let's play cut number one of Matt Gaetz explaining what's really going on with this story.
No, again, I really saw this as a deeply troubling challenge for my family on March 16th when people were, you know, talking about.
So this is obviously a serious allegation. Tell us what the truth is from your perspective.
It is a horrible allegation and it is a lie. The New York Times is running a story that I have traveled with a 17-year-old woman, and that is verifiably false. People can look at my travel records and see that that is not the case. What is happening is an extortion of me and my family involving a former Department of Justice official. On March 16th, my father got a text message demanding a meeting wherein a person demanded $25 million in exchange for making horrible sex trafficking allegations against me go away. Our family was so troubled by that, we went to the local FBI. And the FBI and the Department of Justice were so concerned about this attempted extortion of a member of Congress that they asked my dad to wear a wire, which he did with the former Department of Justice official. Tonight, I am demanding that the Department of Justice and the FBI release the audio recordings that were made under their supervision and at their direction, which will prove my innocence and that will show that these allegations aren't true. They're merely intended to try to bleed my family out of money.
Well, that would be big if true. I mean, obviously, if that's going on, of course. But he also addresses other allegations that are made against him. Here's just one more soundbite from that.
No, again, I really saw this as a deeply troubling challenge for my family on March 16th when people were, you know, talking about a minor and that there were pictures of me with child prostitutes. That's obviously false. There will be no such pictures because no such thing happened. But really on March 16th was when this got going from the extortion standpoint.
From the extortion standpoint. And at one point he says, hey, so Tucker, you and I went to dinner. I brought a friend of mine. You remember her. You were there. And Tucker goes, no, I don't remember that at all. So this investigation apparently was begun not in March. It was begun under the Trump administration, under Bill Barr. So I don't know, Amanda. It's
blow the whole thing open, Charlie. He just needed a little bit more time. And he would have proven, he would have uncovered the crimes that are occurring at Department of Justice. Like, that's what he's saying, right? He's putting out a string of events that, let's see what happens here. So apparently, according to him, a former Department of Justice official, probably under the Trump administration, because this investigation was opened up under the Trump administration, came to Gates's father and said, I need $25 million to make these bad pictures and other illicit things go away. That's Gates's story.
It's a hell of a story. I mean, why would we not believe him? Of course, this is just as Q predicted, that there is this child sex trafficking going on. And wow, it'd be interesting to see how Q handles all of this.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, he wants to show travel records. Show us the travel records. Who knows where this is going, but why did he go on TV to talk about this?
Well, because that's what he does.
Right. And to snare Tucker into it, which is funny. There's a clip going around from a couple, a couple years ago where Gates is retelling a story about how he's at a party with Tucker and Tucker is sitting on one side and he is with a date. You know, he talks about dates that he has a lot in his videos. And Tucker mentioned his show and the girl says, what show do you have? Like, she didn't know who he was. And this was apparently Matt Gaetz's date in his retelling of the story from a few years ago. Like, how do you go on a date with Matt Gaetz knowing he's Matt Gaetz and not know who Tucker Carlson is unless you're really, really, really out of the loop young?
Matt Gaetz is really into telling people about all the times he hung out with Tucker Carlson. And so Tucker Carlson's probably saying, maybe we shouldn't book him again. I don't know. I'm not sure that he's going to be on. So I'm not going to prejudge this investigation, but we are going to watch it, obviously. Because
I was
very
impressed with Tucker's ability to keep his face completely still, only blinking his eyes intermittently while Gates unfurled this whole thing. I mean, it's really amazing. Like he froze his face not to show any emotion. I kept rewatching it, trying to see, like, did he have any reaction at all? No, it was complete disciplined. I'm going stone cold face here. It is pretty incredible.
Well, this is going to be messy because there are other figures in Florida political circles, shall we say, who've been engaged in certain questionable activities. And again, I don't want to get too far out over our skis. Let's jump into this, please. We'll get back to Florida.
It is amazing how Roger Stone keeps turning up in all these stories. For the man who was charged on child trafficking schemes, who is producing, you know, fake IDs for minors and things. Weird he turns up with Roger Stone. Like, how that guy doesn't have a political restraining order to stay away from any elected official or candidate by now is incredible. Roger Stone always turns up. If it's Florida and it's skeezy, you're going to find Roger Stone.
And of course, they all have to have their picture taken with him because that's what they do. Okay. So from the Washington Post this morning, Republicans are opening a new front in the pandemic culture wars, attacking efforts by the Biden administration to develop guidelines for coronavirus vaccination passports that businesses could then use to determine who can safely participate in activities such as flights, concerts, and indoor dining. This has now become a big thing particularly with your favorite governor, Ron DeSantis of Florida, who is really, you know, thinks he can run for president and all this. We are not supporting doing any vaccine passports in the state of Florida. It is completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society. You know, I wrote about this in my newsletter this morning. Wait until they hear about driver's licenses, photo IDs to vote, social security cards, TSA screening, employer drug tests, birth certificates, proof of residence and citizenship, real actual passports, and the certificates of vaccination that we already require. And I actually posted a list of all of the vaccinations that you have to go to school in Florida. And of course, you have to present a certification of vaccination to go to any school at any age in the state of Florida. But this is the new culture war, isn't it now?
Yeah,
vaccine passports.
When this broke out, I guess a few days ago, and people started talking about DeSantis' opposition to this and other opposition from Republicans, anyone that's ever put their child in a public school knows you have to present these kinds of records. Like, it's like, what? I was watching the reaction from, you know, I hate to say it, but Republican male officials calling this draconian, leading the charge on this. And it's like, they have no clue. They have no clue what the kids have to do to go to school. It's like, if you're a mom or a dad that went to those appointments and you had to get your kids jabbed while they scream and hold them down and do that, it is not pleasant. You do not forget it. It is not fun. It's not fun to keep up with all the, you know, different things you have to get if you're worried about it, spacing. I mean, it's a big thing for the first few years of a child's life to keep up with that and then have the papers ready. Yes, the papers to present to the school to gain entry and participate in normal society, as Rand said. But apparently he didn't go to those appointments. Isn't that what he's saying? Like, he's an anti-vaxxer now. This is what being an anti-vaxxer is about. Saying, I shouldn't have to do this to do things like go to school. This is why, you know, there's all this debate that happens in school boards and happened in the West. It's being fought with the kids because they didn't want to do it. There's a bunch of, you know, yuppie liberal parents on the West Coast that don't want to take their kids to go get their darn shots and are worried about autism and all the stuff that starts on the QAnon blogs, linking these things together. I mean, that's where DeSantis is at. He's an anti-vaxxer.
By the way, that's a really good point. That where does this lead? This is going to lead to rejecting the whole notion that you have any kind of a social responsibility to preserve public health by getting a vaccination. But again, as of right now in Florida, if you want to go to a school, if you want to go to a childcare facility, a family daycare home, and any of them, you have to show up with something called Form DH-680. 680, the Florida Certification of Immunization. Try to get in without them. And they keep adding additional requirements to go to school. Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course, becoming the new spokesman for all of this, had some thoughts.
She's probably
about
got
the
some idea. Health vitamins to sell you at her CrossFit gym that'll do you good.
Well, you know what's interesting about this? I mean, I think we talked about this on the podcast yesterday. What makes this so extraordinary from my point of view is that until about 5 minutes ago, weren't Republicans in favor of letting private businesses determine their standards, you know, come up with policies to make their customers and their employees safe? So now guys like DeSantis are essentially saying the government is going to forbid private businesses from having these rules. I mean, and what's next? The no shoes, no shirt, no service signs are going to have to come down. But here's Marjorie Taylor Greene doing her thing with this.
What should not be put over all of us is something called a vaccine passport. A vaccine passport that Americans would be required to have in order to travel, to go to events, to buy and sell. Now, how are they wanting to push this on to Americans? They are talking to private companies, big corporations, big powerful corporations
evil.
That will enforce these policies on you. Because you see, if Democrats pass this law, well then, what will all of us say? We will call them communist. We will call them fascist, right?
Yeah,
these
same
are the
thing.
Names we will
totally
call
same
them.
Thing.
But if the companies do it, then it's a company policy, and they're just saying, oh, this is to keep everyone safe when you fly in their plane.
Free market.
You need your vaccine passport. Oh, if you're going to come into the football game or the baseball game or the concert, you need your vaccine passport because we're trying to do a good job to keep everyone safe. This is what the Biden administration is trying to talk to these private companies into doing. Well, let's analyze that. You see, it's still the same thing. It's still fascism or communism, or whatever you want to call it.
Same thing.
But it's in, it's coming from private companies. So I have a term for that. I call it corporate communism.
Corporate communism. Professor Marjorie Taylor Greene has come up with a new category that has escaped the students of totalitarianism until now, corporate communism. So
I lost brain cells following that.
Oh, I was
going to do this. They'll pass the law, but it's bad because private corporations are doing it. And then it's corporate communism. Like, lady, she just doesn't want to play. Like, this just reminds me of the social media debate where people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, they just don't want to play by any rules, right? Like, don't tell me what to do. I'm going to do whatever I want. And if you restrict me in any way, shape, or manner, it's censorship in corporate communism, right? Like, it's all boils down to the same thing. And that anybody that tells me what I don't want to hear, they're evil and fascist, whatever, reject it. It's just, it's so mind-numbing. It's so stupid.
Well, here's in the category of I'm old enough to remember. I actually was looking for this book. I'm sure I have it in a bookshelf, probably in the next room here. A book by Marianne Glendon, who is a professor at Harvard, who wrote a book about, I think it was called Rights Talk. And this was a big book among conservatives because what it pointed out was, there was all of this rhetoric that at that time was coming from the right. I'm sorry, coming from the left about rights. I have a right to do this. I have a right to do that. And she was saying, well, you know what? We need to balance that out with responsibilities, that with all of these rights come responsibilities. And we need to talk about that. And for about 20 years, this was conventional wisdom among conservatives, that you balanced rights with responsibilities. Sure, you have the right to refuse the vaccination, but then, there are going to be consequences to all of that. And what's lost is this whole sense of communal responsibility, or the responsibility to the community, to your neighbors, to vulnerable people around you, to your coworkers, to other elderly people, to behave in a responsible manner. It's like one wing of what conservatives used to talk about has just fallen off, and all we have left is this kind of this slogan, don't tread on me. I want to do what I want to do no matter what, no matter who I make sick, no matter who I kill, no matter how many grandmas I put in the ground.
Yeah, it's just so whiny. It just makes me think it's the crybaby caucus. It is a crybaby caucus. I don't wanna. It all boils down to that. I don't want to do that.
I don't wanna.
I don't wanna. And it's just repeat, repeat, repeat. But I do think it's worth, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's going to do what she wants to do. But Ron DeSantis is in a much higher place of responsibility as governor of Florida. And so when he declared on Monday that, quote, it's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of a vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society. Well, what about him? Like, he really needs to answer that question, because either Ron DeSantis, you are the one that's completely unresponsible because you enforce these mandates every dang day with the list of vaccines that you pointed out in the newsletter this morning. So what is it? Like, are you completely unacceptable? Or are you just completely full of it? Completely full of it. Because otherwise he'd be rolling back every one of those mandates right now. Lead the way on anti-vaccine policy, Governor DeSantis. If you don't believe in any of it, then I think the people of Florida should probably know.
It's all performative at this point. I mean, it's all performative in order to advance his political career in Florida and perhaps nationally. I'm sorry to double down on the crazy this morning, but I have to do one more thing before we get on to maybe slightly less crazy stuff. Peter Navarro, I gotta know where this is going.
That guy's a weird duck.
He is a weird guy. I mean, he used to be this left wing crank who now has become this right wing crank. He was supposed to be the trade guy, and he's gotten really deep into all sorts of things that are way outside of his, his zone, including, election fraud. He went on Fox last night. With Rachel Campos Duffy, who happens to be from Wisconsin. I can't escape this. I mean, it's just like,
you're responsible, really. I think it all traces back to you, but
I actually am more responsible than I'd like to admit at the moment. Do you know that I actually, when I was the editor of Right Wisconsin, we sponsored this big event called the Right Women Awards to encourage conservative women. And one of the first winners of the Right Women Awards was,
Rachel. What did you do to earn such a prestigious honor?
I'd rather not talk about it anymore.
Okay, now you have to say, so it's not something weird. You've just made it weirder.
No, Rachel Campbell. I mean, she was a very, at that point.
Yeah, she's a mom. How many kids do they have?
She's like about 100. No. But what she was doing was, at that point, this was pre-Trump. She was the voice of Hispanic conservatives pushing the idea that the Republican Party and conservatives needed to be more inclusive and needed to change their tone. I mean, it's where she is now has no relationship to where she used to be, but who knows? So anyway, she was one of the award winners and she gave a speech and it's remembered in Wisconsin circles as one of the longest speeches ever, but whatever. So now she's come to her kingdom. She's a host on Fox News and she's on with Peter Navarro, who is talking about the COVID. Now he's become a vaccine expert. There's a big story in the Washington Post about how he managed to bollocks this whole thing up. But he was on last night and he's calling COVID-19 the Fauci virus. I mean, I have to play this because you're going to think that I'm making this up, you know, that Anthony Fauci, it's not just enough to say that I disagree with Anthony Fauci or Anthony Fauci, as a self-promoter or whatever. He's calling him the father of the virus. Here's Peter Navarro on Fox News, and Rachel Campos Duffy completely lets it slide.
Fauci's the father of the actual virus. Fauci's the guy. This virus, according to Bob Redfield at the Centers for Disease Control, came from the Wuhan lab. And basically, we had Fauci not only funding that lab with American taxpayer dollars, he authorized this thing called gain-of-function research. He allowed the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, to genetically engineer a virus using gain-of-function. I call it the Fauci virus now. If he wants to be the father or something, he's the father of the virus that's killed over 500,000 Americans.
Well, Peter, we're still trying to get to the bottom of that, and we're definitely going to bring you back when we get more information on it. But you're right. There's a lot of questions out there. Peter, I can't thank you enough for joining me today.
This is like another big conspiracy in the Matt Gaetz way that Navarro's just about to explode. So the allegation is that Dr. Fauci somehow collaborated, maybe through the World Health Organization, to fund a Chinese lab to leak the virus and then unleash destruction upon the earth because he's a elitist global killer. Huh?
Yeah, Fauci is the father of the virus. That's very catchy. Oh, for fuck's sake. Part of it is just kind of to remember that up until a few months ago, these guys were running the country. These guys were in the White House.
Navarro's big spiel, I think last year, a couple months ago, was that he was the one inside the White House trying to get people to take this seriously, right? Like trying to buy up supplies and blah, blah, blah. And now he's just twisted it. It's all Fauci's fault. And I will say it's pretty incredible among, you know, Republicans, just, you know, normal Republican people. The thing about Fauci lying about masks is so ingrained. I mean, every time I have a conversation about COVID and masks, well, you know, Dr. Fauci lied about that. You can't kick that stone away. It's not moving. And so that's completely unrelated to this grand conspiracy that Navarro's coming up with. But that's pretty amazing by Fox News. Essentially, like, we'll look into this and have you back. You can explain further. I mean, this is a new narrative. Like, tell me more.
Well, and the Post is reporting this morning that Navarro privately urged Trump to acquire these critical medical supplies in the early days of the coronavirus outbreak. And then after he was ignored, Navarro went off and pursued his own ad hoc strategy that blew more than $1 billion in federal funds that has prompted multiple probes. I mean,
was this part of the Jared Kushner thing? God, where's that guy?
We just had these cranks and these weird. Yeah, where is Jared Kushner? Is he probably polishing his Nobel Peace Prize somewhere?
Probably.
So okay,
he's enjoying his peace in the Middle East that he brokered.
Because that was easy. So interesting story that these two Capitol police officers are now suing Donald Trump for for his role in inciting the insurrection. I actually think that that's somewhat significant because, again, it opens another legal venue to gather more information and perhaps force people to tell what they know, what they knew and what the and when they knew it.
So this is the communications that still went on in the White House, that's still a complete black box, right? For what people did at the White House in those hours that the insurrection was unfolding and those frontline Capitol Hill officers were left to just fend for themselves. This is going to go on for a long time. Was it yesterday that something like 14,000 hours of surveillance tape had just been turned over to the House Oversight Committee? I mean, this is not over.
No, it is not. It's not over. And if it takes these private civil lawsuits to break open the truth, then I'm all for that. I mean, obviously, there's the ongoing criminal investigations, which are important. I have less and less confidence that Congress is going to be able to do anything, certainly not on a bipartisan basis. But, you know, these civil lawsuits like the Dominion lawsuit about the big election lie could make a difference.
You know, I started to make a list of all the unresolved big lawsuits that are still swirling around. There's Dominion, Smartmatic. These from the Capitol Police officers, Georgia Secretary of State criminal investigation, Trump's, taxes and whether he overinflated assets for personal tax gain. I mean, those are just off the top of my head. And those are all pretty big and may take, not this year, 1, 2, 3 years.
Well, and there was just a ruling yesterday, right, in that lawsuit from the woman who was claiming, I think she's suing Trump for defamation because she had said that, he had groped her and then he denied it and said she had made it up. So, yeah, there are a lot of these things that are going on right now.
Eugene Carroll still?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this memo. And I want to get your insight on all this because there's something I don't understand about it. This is this new memo from somebody in the House Republican Conference that argues that the Republicans' future demands, they, quote, embrace our new coalition because President Trump's gift didn't come with a receipt, whatever that means. So the headline is cementing GOP as the working class party. And Axios is reporting it leaves no doubt that Republicans, at least in the House, will be doubling down on Donald Trump for the foreseeable future. So we kind of knew this, right? What do the Republicans mean when they say that they are the working class party right now? I'm a little vague on this.
Well, they keep saying it, which is so funny. It just reminds me of talks I'd have with Senator DeMint and Senator Cruz, where they would say, I'm going to be hopeful and optimistic. I'm going to be hopeful and optimistic, and that's how we'll win races. Like, they would both say these things in speeches, and we'd have to sit them down and say, you can't just say I'm hopeful and optimistic. Like, you just have to project that in the things that you talk about. And that's what they're doing here by saying we're the party of the working class. What does that mean? What does that mean? Are they working frontline jobs? Do they have a coalition of people that work minimum wage and are truly paycheck to paycheck, that work retail, the kind of menial jobs that really represents the working class? Because every time I see them talk about it, it has to do with like business owners, which is great. It's always small business, but there's a huge difference between being a small business owner and being a true member of the working class and kind of a service sector economy or a manual labor job, in my mind.
I mean, maybe we're just misreading this. Maybe they're just saying, we're going to, appeal to these folks on culture war grounds. But in terms of the working class, it obviously doesn't mean support for unions. It doesn't mean opposition to right to work laws. It doesn't mean raising the minimum wage. It doesn't mean making it easier to get health care. It doesn't mean, family leaves or anything like that. It doesn't mean more occupational safety regulations. They're going to vote. Going into the midterms, they will have voted against any of the infrastructure packages, right? Any of these things that would actually go into the pockets of folks. I'm not saying that I would have voted for these things. I'm just saying that, in what way are they working class? With the possible exception of we're in favor of higher tariffs on China. I mean, it'd be outside of trade. What is the working class agenda?
The only way I can really read it is that it's more geographic and we are going to focus on the Trump coalition that is predominantly represented by people in rural areas.
Well, this is from the memo. So they're going to go heavy on immigration. They're going to contrast the GOP's immigration policies against the Biden border crisis. They're going to obviously hammer China and their predatory trade practices, and then they're going to go after Wall Street, big corporations. The Democrats' coziness with China results from their coziness with Wall Street. They're going to hammer the Democrats on the lockdowns. They're going to hammer wokeness and identity politics. Obviously, they hate big tech. The author of this memo suggests Republicans hold working class roundtables, create a working families task force. I don't know what that means. But I think part of it is, and I think you pointed this out on Twitter, they will embrace the blacklist, the corporations that say that they're not going to give them money because they voted to overturn the election. So they're going to make that a badge of honor that they are anti-business now. So anti-big business, I guess.
And that was actually the most interesting part of the memo, because I think that's pretty smart of them to do, right? Look, they're not going to be getting the corporate donations from a Coca-Cola because the progressive left is watching the donations like a hawk and drawing line of democracy, which I think is very smart for the left to do. It's what I believe in doing as well. If these people are not going to agree to the concept of a free and fair election, then no one should support them. Without elections, we don't have any kind of democracy, period, the end. But what they're saying now, and I think they're smart tactically, because this is the only road, this is the only card they have to play, saying like, okay, put us on the blacklist. We're going to double down on the insurrection. We're not going to apologize for it. We're not going to change course at all. We're going to say that it was the right thing to do. And we're going to try to pull a Bernie Sanders and just say, we don't want your corporate donations anyway, and try to pursue a low dollar independent fundraising model. I mean, good luck with that. I think you can do that more easily on a national level when you have a presidential race, that only happens every 4 years. Can you actually replicate that model for House guys who are up every 2 years? Ooh, I think that, they're chomping down the Tums right now and trying to do online fundraising only in small $5 increments versus, these breakfasts that they would do where everyone that showed up would give them at least $1,500. You go to some dinners, people have $10,000 a table, but that is probably what Republicans should do, even though I think it's kind of shaky.
So it became a joke during, and I'm trying not to turn this into a joke, but it became a joke during the Trump years that this was infrastructure week, and you had one infrastructure week after another, and next week's going to be infrastructure week, and of course never happened. I've often thought that if Trump would have started with a big infrastructure package, that a lot of his presidency would have turned out very, very differently. Do you agree with that?
I don't know, because here's my thing about infrastructure week and infrastructure bills. Nobody knows what the heck it means. I mean, you could have 10 different people in a room and they would all give you a different thing that they think infrastructure means to them. To me, it's roads, bridges, hardwired stuff, cement, pavement, that kind of thing. You ask somebody else, they say it's healthcare. You ask somebody else, they say it's education. And so what it always ends up being is some kind of free-for-all. And we're going to end up with what, $2 trillion bill is what Biden is talking about. I was buzzing through the Washington Post story. One of the items in there was that they're going to replace every lead pipe in America, which okay, great. I'm not for lead pipes. Lead is pretty bad for you, but you're going to rip up every building that has a lead pipe. I mean, where are they all? Have you talked to any historic commission for these old buildings? That's on the agenda. What? How about we just have a pilot program to test all the bridges that are about ready to bust and fix those? It's just, there's such a resistance to doing something that is accountable and could be a demonstration project that everybody could see and understand, because infrastructure is stimulus and it's just, we're just going to roll everything up like they did the voting rights bill, which is way too big, and have 800 pages of something, 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 and nobody likes it.
And it's just too much. I mean, yeah, you mentioned this. Every lead pipe in the country would be replaced. I guess I would like to know more about that. There's a reason, by the way, why they're still there, because of the logistics of getting to them. I mean, this would be a wonderful thing if they, you know, magically vanished, but it's going to cost a lot of money. Here's another thing. This plan will enable drivers across the country to find electric charging stations for their vehicles on the road. So does this mean that the government is going to buy, is going to build these electric charging stations? I guess I missed the part where, you know, Eisenhower's infrastructure bill built all the gas stations. Did the government build gas stations?
Is it carbon friendly to get rid of all the gas powered cars and immediately transition the entire fleet to electric cars and build new gas stations? Like, is that carbon friendly to just build new stuff all the time? No, it really isn't.
So I'm not clear everything that's in there. And of course, this proposal, this $2 trillion jobs and infrastructure plan, would be
paid for. Can I rip on the broadband part real quick?
The what part?
the part, there was a plink in there too to have broadband everywhere.
Oh, sure. That's a big one. Yeah.
Elon Musk is going to have the satellites up in the sky before that ever happens. It's like, you do not have to build out broadband. It is coming. Private sector will take care of that. But by the time they get it wired and spent, how much are they going to do on that when it's already coming? It's just, I don't think this is well thought out. And Biden would be so much well served to have clear demonstration projects that he can go cut the ribbon on and say, here's what the money went. Look at how beautiful it is. You know, go replace all the lead pipes in public schools. I'd be happy with that. That would be verifiably good. But that's not, they're Democrats. It's not what they want to do.
Well, they're talking about paying for it in part by raising the corporate tax rate and the global minimum tax. And of course, the Chamber of Commerce has already come out against that. I guess I have mixed feelings about this, that if you're going to spend this much money, we're going to have to pay for it at some point. You know, we continue to spend, you know, like a social welfare state, and we tax like we're some sort of a medieval Hamlet. But it at some point they're going to have to pay for it. But I'm still a little confused. The American Jobs Plan. Okay, this is the $2 trillion plan. Is that right? The $2 trillion plan. Here's a line from the Washington Post.
Oh wait, did we just spend $5 trillion?
Well, I'm going to get to this. So we just spent $5 trillion. So the American Jobs Plan is the next $2 trillion, right? The American Jobs Plan is expected to be followed by a second economic package in April that includes a major expansion in health insurance coverage, childcare subsidies, free access to community colleges, and other proposals.
Okay.
Okay. At some point, I really do. I know that a lot of the fiscal conservatives turned out to be complete phonies and hypocrites. That they
no,
didn't
but we
mean
get
it.
To complain because we didn't do that. We get to complain about it.
Okay, so here's just kind of a list. The infrastructure is actually only $620 billion from this. So the big question, where's the rest? So you have a lot of money to revamp highways, roads, 10 major and 10,000 smaller bridges that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm, I like
$85 billion to modernize existing transit systems. Okay, rider demand, fine. $80 billion to fix Amtrak's repair backlog. You knew that Biden was going to spend money on trains, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else? It seeks to replace 50,000 diesel transit vehicles and electrify at least 20% of the country's yellow bus fleet. $25 billion investment in airports. $17 billion for inland waterways, coastal ports, land ports of entry. Fine, not a big deal. The American Jobs Plan targets 40% of climate and clean infrastructure investments to disadvantaged communities. Okay. And then that's $620 billion. Then there's another infrastructure at home, $650 billion, $213 billion to build and retrofit more than 2 million homes.
Whose homes?
Well, I'm unclear. This would rehabilitate more than 500,000 homes for low and middle income buyers and invest $40 billion to improve public housing. So I'm not sure about that. Then you mentioned broadband. Lead pipes is $111 billion. The effort would reduce lead exposure in 400,000 schools and childcare facilities. I'm not against that. Proposal calls for $100 billion to upgrade and build new public schools. I think there's probably some room to do that.
Wait, didn't the schools get like $120 billion in the COVID bill?
Well, yes. This is the problem is that when you have these multiple bills, Have you figured out how to spend the money you've already allocated? Now, there's something called the care economy, that there would also be $400 billion. Plan expands access to home or community-based care for seniors and people with disabilities. Extend this Medicare program. Money follows the person to move elderly nursing home residents out of nursing home residents back into their homes. That sounds like a good thing. Research and development, manufacturing and training is $580 billion.
And that's an infrastructure bill.
This is all
talking about infrastructure. I'm hearing schools, I'm hearing nursing homes, I'm hearing broadband. I heard a little bit about bridges, but we're still in infrastructure, right?
The plan invests $50 billion in domestic semiconductor manufacturing. Now, I'm sorry to sound like an old conservative here, but isn't domestic semiconductor manufacturing the kind of thing that the private sector would be able to do?
I'm pretty sure. Is there a shortage? I mean, I've got to look into this, but hey, I guess I have one question. Have we crushed COVID yet? Is that done?
Well,
are we out of the pandemic yet? Happened? Are they just checking the box on that, ready to move on?
Well, I can't decide whether or not we have impending doom, as CDC has said the other day, or whether or not we really have crushed it because of the vaccines. And we're getting some good numbers. I don't know. I guess at a certain point, this is the problem. And I know I'm going to get blowback from this. This is the problem of these things not being bipartisan, that I really get the sense that Democrats have folded in on themselves and are talking to themselves. And you made a brief reference to HR1, which has a lot of good stuff in it. It's got a lot of good stuff, but it is so packed with wish lists and talking points that it's become unwieldy and may crash and burn because it's not pared down. It's not narrowly focused. And so, and I'm watching increasingly on social media that liberals are basically saying, yeah, we just got to do this now. We got to ram it through. We don't need to compromise. We don't need to talk to the other side. And so you are getting this sort of hermetically sealed progressive agenda that I kind of wonder at some point whether or not, you know, Americans are going to go, wait, where's all the money coming from? Where's it all going? Did we really mean to do all of that? And by the way, we do have a border crisis, and we haven't necessarily licked the pandemic yet. What are we doing here?
I wonder, you know, I listened to a few progressive podcasts, and it seems to me they're walking into the mistake of the Obama stimulus bill all over again. Because as I recall, Barack Obama wasn't like congratulated for all the wonderful stimulus spending that he did to get people out of the 2009-ish recession. Right? He had problems because a lot of people viewed that as government waste that didn't drastically improve the lives of people who needed it most. That's why Republicans took back the House, blah, blah, blah. If you listen to the progressives, they say, well, Obama's problem was that he didn't spend enough. I don't think they're right about that. And now the Obama people think that Biden can just package this up as infrastructure spending and repeat the same stupid mistake. Joe Biden only has to do one thing to be successful, and that is to crush COVID and to make sure that schools are open. I do not like the first COVID relief bill because there is a lot of non-COVID related spending, but fine. Like maybe he gets a pass on that because they had to do something early on. He's not going to keep getting that pass. You know, the $86 billion in union pension bailouts that was wrapped up in that? I mean, come on. There was all kinds of money for schools, which is fine. But yes, they should spend that first. But well, if they keep getting away with this, they are sorely, sorely mistaken.
And I do get the sense that you have, you know, folks sitting around the room and they're going, well, you know, what do you want to throw in? Well, we're going to throw in this bailout for the union pension funds, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. And you look at this other package and it does look like a committee. A committee sat around and everybody had their wish list and they shoved it into the middle of the table and somebody stapled it all together. I mean, that's the way it feels.
Yeah. It's kind of how they do it.
I know. People don't really want to know how these things get done. So, I mean, I think there's basically the Biden administration's success is you said two things. I mean, you have to lick the pandemic. You have to, you know, end this, get us back to a normal life. You have to make sure that the economy recovers. And obviously all of, you know, getting people back to school is essential to all of that. I mean, all of that.
It makes me very uneasy that they're so quick to talk about increasing tax rates while businesses have not recovered from COVID. It is too early for that.
Well, see, here's the part that I'm confused about is that we're much of these relief packages are aid to businesses. We're actually here in the state of Wisconsin, we got something like $3 billion the governor gets to dole out unilaterally, by the way. He doesn't even have to talk to the legislature about it. He gets to dole out. And he's giving it out to businesses, so which is fine because they're hurting. And at the same time, talking about raising taxes. Now, maybe we're talking about different businesses. Maybe we're just talking about, you know, the corporate tax rate. The, you know, American corporations are doing well, and it's the small mom and pop businesses that we're providing the aid. Maybe that's the answer to all of this. I have to tell you, I don't have viscerally that much of an objection to raising the taxes as I do to this growing bipartisan belief that we don't need to care about the national debt. I mean, we are sort of like, you know, whistling past this issue. And, you know, look, the Republicans and Donald Trump contributed to this massively by essentially giving up on the issue, you know, turning around once they got power and going, suckers, we don't care. We're going to run up the deficit. We don't care about deficit. We're going to add trillions of dollars. So they basically have destroyed their credibility on the issue. And now you have Democrats coming in and saying, hey, just we're going to put the pedal to the metal. We're just going to spend at a rate that is just, it's breathtaking by any measures, people. And I do wonder about that. So I'm less worried about raising some of the marginal tax rates at the moment on even the rich who have been doing quite well and corporations who have been doing quite well than I do loading trillions of dollars onto the national credit card, which is going to be there forever.
Right, because the corporate tax, you can raise as much as you want. You're not going to make up a $1 trillion budget gap. I mean, there's not trillionaires in the American economy that you can tax to get that money. It doesn't add up. I mean, try it. Still won't work. You're still spending too much. It's like when you exercise. You can't, if you have a, you know, 5,000 calorie breakfast, a 2,000 calorie lunch, and then a 10,000 calorie dinner, it doesn't matter if you go running for 9 hours. It doesn't matter if you run a marathon that day. You can't work it off.
Really? Huh.
Oh, I don't know. Well, maybe not a marathon.
By the way, that explains a
you
lot.
You can't, what's the saying? You can't outrun a bad diet, which is good because I don't like running.
So now that you're back, what are you looking at? What is grinding your gears now?
I'm finally going to write about Kristi Noem. I've been looking at her. Yeah. You know, it's really interesting to watch her position herself. The interview she did with Tucker Carlson the other night was incredibly revealing to me, and how she has been so savagely attacked by the conservative media for her trying to chart out a different course on the transgender issue stuff. She agrees with Tucker Carlson and, like, you know, all the, I don't know, Daily Wires, all those
people. Yeah.
They have the same goal, but they don't like the strategy that she is pursuing to try to accomplish the same goal. And so all of a sudden they just piled on her like nobody's business. And then the next, you know, she's been on this like rehab tour talking to everybody, Federalist, Breitbart, Glenn Beck. And she had this kind of odd exchange with Glenn Beck where he kind of chuckled and said, you know, kind of, how's it going? It's amazing how fast people can turn on you, huh? And she's like, yeah, yeah. And then she went on her way in her robotic way. But yeah, and it's also interesting to watch how much Tucker and Sean Hannity try to position her against Ron DeSantis when DeSantis is clearly their favorite, because they have been jockeying to see who's the most anti-lockdown, you know, kind of COVID crusader. And every time they ask her a question, it's like, well, you just did what Ron DeSantis did, didn't you? I mean, they're pushing her into that second place behind him and just putting her in her spot. And it's sort of brutal to watch. I mean, I think it's pretty shameful, but she's gonna sit there and take it because she can't do anything about it.
She can't do anything about it. She signed on to this. She bought this ticket. And the thing about it is that, you know, being the governor of South Dakota, it's going to be hard to compete with the governor of Florida. She just can't kill as many people as Ron DeSantis. You just can't. Right?
Yep. So off the ticket. She's going to take the rodeo ride. Cowgirl queen.
Amanda Carpenter, thanks so much for joining me. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.